I'm very pleased and excited to introduce today's two featured presenters, Dr. Danny Rival and Dr. Mike Plumero. Danny is with the University of Texas, Austin, and before joining UT, he spent over 23 years with Louisiana State University. And Mike is now a private consulting engineer. Prior to this, he spent over 30 years with the Corps of Engineers. Needless to say, and as many of you likely are aware, both have extensive experience in contaminated sediment remediation. So before I turn it over to Danny, who's going to be the first presenter, I remind everyone again to place your phones on mute and do not use the hold button.
Kelly, this is Leah Evison. May I ask that regional participants send me an email and let me know who in your region is in the room? Thank you.
All right. With that said, I feel free to start, Danny.
Okay, thank you, Kelly. Well, I'm going to have the first half of today's seminar, and I'm going to be focusing on capping materials and design. I'm going to start that with an introduction that's really an overview of capping and why we might select capping. And then I'm going to turn to some of the information that's found in the sediment remediation guidance, in particular in Chapter 5 that focuses on capping, and also on Chapter 7, which talks about capping and other remedies and relative comparison of those remedies and selection of remedies. Then I have a little discussion of performance monitoring before I get into the specifics of design. And initially, I'll focus on sand caps, relative design, which is the most common example of caps, and then turn to some of the current issues in capping and active capping, which is where I'll stop, and then turn it over to Mike to discuss the practical implementation of capping. Well, with that, let me turn to the second slide, and all my slides are in the A series, and they will be numbered. I'll just refer to the number, and I'm moved on to slide 2. Among the options that we have for managing contaminated sediment, as we know, dredging, monitored natural recovery, and in between are in-situ options, which are really quite limited. There is some potential for treatment, but we really have very limited options in that area, and they've been largely unproven. Many of the sediment contaminants that we're concerned about are very strongly sorbed, and many of the fate processes that might encourage, for example, degradation, require desorption. And so for a variety of reasons, but in particular because of the type of contaminants and also the limited options to deliver reagents or other ingredients that you might need to encourage treatment options, there really are fairly limited options, although there is some work ongoing to try to improve them. But today we're going to focus on capping and really a containment approach to contain the contaminated sediments. And we have a lot of instances where capping has been shown to be effective and has worked well in the field. And it does provide a ability to contain, especially those strongly sediment-associated contaminants. There is the potential with capping, because it does not directly treat the contaminants, there is this potential for long-term risk if the cap isn't designed properly, or if there ultimately that cap may be lost, or there are processes that may lead to compromising of that cap. In terms of cap functions, and I moved on to slide 3, it does stabilize sediment. So the very first thing that you can achieve with a cap is the avoidance of erosion and resuspension, if it's properly designed, of that underlying sediment material, and that may in fact be the primary source of risk of that underlying sediment. So just the stabilization can be very positive. It does physically isolate that sediment, and it does reduce the contaminant flux to the overlying water even in the absence of erosive processes. And it also isolates the sediment, the contaminated sediment, from the benthic community, again, if properly designed, where that benthic community and the interactions that they have with those sediments may again be one of the primary sources of exposure and risk at a site. So a cap can do all of those things, and in addition could improve the quality of the aquatic habitat if we wish to apply a substrate that might be more appropriate or a better substrate for whatever is the desired functions of this system. If I move to the fourth slide, just real quickly, and again, we're going to revisit a lot of these. This is a bit of an overview, But if we look at that fourth slide, we can see some of the quick or the advantages of capping. Very quick risk reduction. It's usually fairly quick and easy to implement. It's relatively cost-effective. And you do have a potential, since you're adding material into the environment, to enhance, for example, the substrate, improve habitat opportunities. But there is the disadvantage, as I mentioned before, the sediments remain in the aquatic environment, and that is, especially for a poorly designed cap, a potential source of exposure and risk. There is often, unless it's preceded by dredging, you're reducing water depth, which itself may be a negative relative to the habitat values that you're trying to restore within the system. There is a long-term monitoring and maintenance issue, since we have the contaminants remaining in the environment. And since, again, you have this structure that is going to be in place for a very long period of time, some institutional controls are necessary to implement it. And the fifth slide is just a reminder of some of the key issues as why capping is often chosen as a remedy, and cost is one of those. The rapid implementation, just as shown in the preceding slide. There may be situations as well where the risk associated with the implementation of dredging may be of concern. For example, particularly highly contaminated sediment, or if there is debris and other things that may cause residuals to be difficult to control, capping may be an alternative that might be a better alternative. Lack of the disposal alternatives for that dredge material is another reason. And again, the potential, at least, for habitat improvements with capping. On the sixth slide, I'm beginning a sequence now where I'm referring back to the sediment remediation guidance that summarizes some of the key concepts and issues of capping, considerations of capping that you should keep in mind, and that, again, you can refer for the details to the sediment remediation guidance. And in particular, Chapter 5, which is focused specifically on in situ capping. Slide 7 illustrates some of the site conditions that are especially conducive to capping, and some of the things that I've already alluded to, for example, the things such as buried debris, they may be compatible with a cap, or perhaps the infrastructure needs that are associated with the site may be compatible with a cap, but may, if they were already existing, may be not compatible with other activities like dredging. Is water depth sufficient to deal with a cap, or would other activities such as dredging first have to come into play? Are some of these other issues, again, the hydrodynamic conditions are not likely to compromise the cap, and we'll get into some of those details later on. A little bit further down, one of the key issues with capping is often associated with advective flow or groundwater flow in a cap, and sometimes this may be of significant concern long-term relative to the performance of a cap. Are there processes such as groundwater flow that may ultimately compromise that cap? And that's just a site-specific analysis and assessment, but these are potentially significant issues, and they're outlined in this box. In slide 8, I'm hitting in detail, as described in the sediment remediation guidance, some of the advantages of the capping. I can't overstate the issue of the quickly reduces exposure. In general, capping can be implemented relatively quickly, and it could even be considered as an interim solution while other decisions might be made. But it does allow you to quickly reduce exposure, and that has significant advantages. It requires less infrastructure, which is one of the key ingredients associated with cost. We're not handling dredge material. We're not concerned about dewatering a dredge material, treating that dredge material, treating water, or disposal of the dredge material. So there are significant advantages of being able to deal with the contaminants in situ. I mentioned before the ability of providing a clean substrate, but also a substrate that might be of more appropriate characteristics. Often many of our rivers have been deteriorated over time as a result of the introduction of fine-grained sediments that perhaps were not there in the past, let's say pre-urbanization. And sometimes this capping could be a way of restoring that coarse material into the sediment. if we're concerned about resuspension and loss of contaminants during active remediation, again, in situ capping typically would be lower than other approaches such as dredging in terms of these issues. We do avoid the transport and disposal of contaminated sediment by that might occur with dredging, and capping can generally be implemented with conventional equipment. Mike will be talking about that in a lot more detail. Okay. If we move on to slide 9, again, this is just a restatement as stated from or as coming from the guidance, so that you can use this to evaluate how you're going through the guidance, or to guide you through the guidance, if you will. That we do have this difficulty of if the cap is going to be disturbed, then there is concerns about that residual risk that's associated with the contaminants that are still in place, not being directly treated, but simply being contained. And if we lose containment, we've lost our remediation. We do have the contaminants that might move through the cap, and again, this is the groundwater issue that might be of a special concern. Upwelling is one of those issues that may be of concern relative to contaminant migration, especially if the contaminants are more soluble and more subject to migration as a result of upwelling. In some environments, for example, steep slopes, very, very soft material, it may be difficult to place a cap without having a lot of disruption of the underlying sediment and the potential risk that may occur. And then again, in the shallow water bodies, there may be issues relative to rules that may disallow the application of caps, but also at least problems that may result in the need to place institutional controls to avoid, as listed here, anchoring and boats actually grounding on the bottom. And slide 10, it's important to recognize that the guidance is very open to the consideration of capping, is that in general the guidance indicates that it should not be presumptively disqualified or presumptively assumed as the remedy. Rather, we're looking at high or low energy areas, for example. It may be that a cap is more likely to be effective with minimal armoring in a low energy environment where there's less erosion, but that it is possible, perhaps, in a particular situation to design around a high-energy situation. And so it should not be presumed that a cap is either going to be ineffective or effective, but it requires site-specific assessment and evaluation. On slide 11, some of the considerations that the guidance points out that need to be considered by project managers that are considering capping. Appropriate materials is right at the top of that, and we'll talk a little bit more later as to what those materials might be. The geotechnical considerations associated with the underlying material. This is a very soft. Will it support a cap? Is there effective excessive consolidation? And as a result, excessive expression of pore water and the contaminants that might contain. Placement methods that may work in a particular situation. For example, again, especially if we have areas such as slopes where there might be some special considerations or concerns, or the very soft material, are there placement methods available that allow us to manage those risks with capping? And then ultimately, with any remedial approach, we need to identify the performance objectives and the monitoring methods to evaluate our performance relative to those objectives. In slide 12, some of this is summarized, again, drawn directly from the guidance, and I should point out, since I haven't mentioned it so far, right at the top, the importance of source control, which is true for any active remedial approaches or any given sediment remediation approaches. If there are continuing sources, we at least need to understand them and to understand if they will, in fact, invalidate the remedy or are they manageable within the context of our remedy. And some of the others, I just invite you to look back through them. Some of these I've mentioned. Some of these are just some specific points that we'll touch on as we go through the rest of the talk. Okay. That was the kind of a summary of Chapter 5, which focuses specifically on in situ capping. If we're trying to evaluate capping relative to other remedy approaches, then Chapter 7 provides some useful information from the sediment remediation guidance. And here is just some information on the to encourage the open evaluation of various remedial options. And moving to the next slide, slide 14, it's just recognizing the importance of a fair comparison of the various alternatives, recognizing that there are a number of components of any treatment or any remediation alternative. For example, in capping, we have to get the capping material from somewhere. We have to be able to have access to a site. We are causing some disruption during the placement of that cap, and then we have to actually be able to place the cap effectively and maintain it. In dredging, we have others, such as the treatment, the rest of the terrain associated with treatment of water, dewatering, and then treatment of that water and disposal. So the comparing the remedies, we need to look at that entire terrain and compare them on a net risk reduction basis, recognizing that some of these components, some of these associated components at times actually may increase risk or cause their own difficulties. And if we don't consider those various components, we're not really doing a fair comparison. On slide 15, some of those elements that need to be considered for comparative evaluation net risk reduction are identified specifically relative to M&R, relative to in-situ capping, and relative to dredging. And again, I invite you to just look through those. There's some of these same issues that I had just mentioned, but in addition, some of the practical concerns during implementation, for example, the fourth one in the in-situ capping list, worker risk during transported cap materials and cap placement, kind of the complement of worker risk during sediment removal and handling during the dredging and excavation efforts. Slide 16 recognizes that any time we implement a remedy, we need to be able to evaluate the performance of that remedy. And this just summarizes, again, from the guidance, some of the key issues associated with performance monitoring of capping itself. And number one on that list, of course, is does the cap achieve what is desired, namely physical and chemical isolation of the contaminant, stabilization of the sediment, and ultimately reduction of exposure and risk. Slide 17, some of the specific issues that we've already alluded to and we'll be referring to again in the design considerations. The same things that we need to design against in capping are the things that we need to be able to evaluate in the performance monitoring program. For example, loss of the cap, corrosion, the inability of a cap to provide adequate containment, the contaminant flux. And then whether the recolonization of the cap surface, whether that's a positive or a negative, maybe that's desired, but if we didn't adequately design the cap, it may be that bioturbation is still occurring within the underlying sediment beneath the cap. For example, if we had too thin of a cap and we had a lot of bioturbation of that underlying material. Those are things that would give rise to contaminant flux from the cap, would give rise to exposure to benthic community, and things that we need to monitor terms of performance of that cap. But any performance monitoring is, rather whatever remedy we're employing, and the guidance points this out, that performance monitoring needs to be connected to what the cap's trying to do, how is it trying to intervene in our understanding of a conceptual site model in terms of reducing exposure and risk, and how does that cap ultimately achieve what our remedial objectives are, and the monitoring is designed to evaluate exactly that. In slide 19, it's just a summary of just pointing out sometimes it may be as simple as just monitoring cap integrity and water column, or it may require more detailed monitoring of, for example, migration into the bottom of a cap through coring, for example. All right. Well, with that, I'd like to turn to the next phase, which is really beginning to focus on design of the cap. How do we apply some of those general principles that the guidance has identified? How do we put that in place in actually designing a cap? And a lot of this discussion is going to be focused on sand caps because those are the most common caps and perhaps the easiest to implement, and they can be quite effective, especially for these very strongly sediment-associated contaminants. So on slide 20, I'm looking at, first of all, the screening process, some of the issues that, in a little bit more detail than I did before, that might encourage you to think of capping. How do we evaluate whether a future use of a site might be appropriate for capping or inappropriate for capping? Sometimes I think we don't do enough that the Department of Transportation seems to be able to very efficiently come to a conclusion as to how high a bridge ought to be, which clearly has very significant implications for future uses of a waterway. Sometimes I don't think we're nearly as effective in defining future uses for some of our remediation, but it's certainly an important component of evaluating whether a cap might be appropriate or not. The contaminant stability, namely what are the processes that give rise to contaminant migration, and how can a cap manage those? So, for example, if we have very strong stored contaminants, not much advection, not much deep bioturbation, these might be things that would indicate that capping is likely to be implemented very easily or relatively easily without special considerations. The sediment itself, its stability, how do we decide whether, what is the long-term stability of this? Sometimes we have relatively short records of erosion and storm events in some waterways, and how can we say something about hundreds of years down the pike? And some of the ways that we might do that is, for example, morphological analyses of the rivers. Is this a meandering stream that's likely to continue to move around, or is it one that's well-confined with relatively well-defined flows? A lot of these are human-dominated environments where the flows are relatively defined, but some are not. Buried infrastructure, as mentioned before, it's one of those key issues. Is this is access to that buried infrastructure important, or is the potential for a removal caused more of an issue with buried infrastructure? This is an issue that could either be a plus or a minus relative to capping. Debris is often advantageous for capping, but it could still be a plus or a minus. It is certainly an issue relative to dredging. Sometimes capping can be a more effective way to manage debris, namely because you don't have to actively manage that debris sometimes, depending upon the degree and whether it's needed to remove that material or not. And then water depth, as pointed out before, is certainly an issue. If water depth is not an issue, it becomes a little easier to apply capping. Slide 21, as I mentioned, sand caps are a majority of existing caps, and they are quite effective if we have contaminants strongly sorbed to the solid phase of the sediment. They're relatively easy to place because they settle quite well through the water column, and they can often be placed on very soft sediment. And compared to the fine-grained sediment that they're replacing often, they are often much more erosion-resistant than that fine-grained sediment, but may be necessary to supplement with an armoring layer. I mentioned before habitat value. Sometimes something like sand could provide that coarser material that might provide some diversity. It could be a positive, although, again, it could also be a negative relative to the desired substrate you'd like to see. Slide 22 summarizes the details of technical guidance for in-situ capping, and so this is not as what includes the contaminated sediment remediation guidance, but also two very specific guidance documents that provide more of the technical details, a lot of the things that I'm talking about today. Slide 23 shows the elements of cap designs and shows that there are quite a variation in cap designs depending upon the particular situation that might be present. It might be as an Eagle Harbor or simply a sand layer that is considered sufficiently robust in itself, but it didn't require additional armoring, or at least if there was erosion in particular areas, it was not considered to have disastrous consequences, if you will. Whereas in others, for example, in Sheboygan, relatively high-flow environment, there was a need to have armoring of that material with these cobbles. In the Sheboygan case, there was an attempt to armor banks, and so required much more coarser material at the surface. In general, a cap has, above the underlying sediment, there's a zone which tends to intermix with the cap layer when we place it. There, especially in soft sediment, there's some degree of intermixing. And then there's a layer that we usually refer to as the isolation layer. This is the layer that we want to have remain in place to achieve the objectives of a cap. And then to make sure that stays in place, we have an armoring layer atop that, and then potentially we could put a habitat layer on top of that to provide the values that we'd like to have the river to ultimately have, or the bottom substrate to ultimately have. Those component layers are described more in slide 24. The intermixing layer, again, is the layer. It's often might be as little as 1 to 2 inches. Oftentimes, it might consider it to be as much as 4 to 6 inches if we were concerned about fairly soft sediment. It could potentially be more, although I know of very few cases where it's even as much as 4 to 6 inches for most of the sediment systems that we're worrying about, where we're placing sand on top of, directly on top of sediment. How much intermixing would you see? An upper bound is generally of the order of 4 to 6 inches. As a result of the placement of a cap, we tend to see some consolidation of the underlying sediment, and so that expresses water into the overlying cap material. Now, that water does contain contaminants, although if the cap has any degree of sorption capacity whatsoever, that migration associated with the pore water expression is typically very, very small. So even a cap that only had a sandy cap that had a very small fraction of organic carbon, for example, would likely effectively retard any migration due to pore water expression by consolidation of something like a PCB. The isolation layer is the layer above that intermixing layer. Potentially, if the consolidation layer is significant, we might exclude that from the isolation layer, but in general, the consolidation layer in terms of chemical expression is very small. So the isolation layer is basically that above the intermixing layer, and that's the one that's designed to achieve the objectives of the cap. And as I mentioned, the armoring layer, followed by a layer, should you choose to add it, of a biologically active layer that is the layer that would provide habitat. It's always the top layer, often just the top 4 to 6 inches, the top layer where organisms will repopulate. And so if we have a bottom substrate that's most appropriate for that, that would be at the top. If we don't have that layer, then the organisms would presumably be forced to recolonize, if appropriate, the armoring layer, or perhaps not. Or if we don't even need armoring, we're looking at the upper portion of the isolation layer. And we usually have to add a component to the isolation layer, recognizing the upper layer will be compromised by that bioturbation, by the presence of organisms and their mixing processes, which is called bioturbation. On slide 25, some of the key features of where we usually design for when we're evaluating the actual implementation of capping. The zone of exposure is really where these organisms populate, that upper 4 to 6 inches. And so that typically is where we're of primary concern. And we try to set standards for the cap that'll protect that. It's not necessarily the concentration in that zone. It might be a concentration below it. But their basic goal is to protect that zone where the organisms might be living. It's typically based on maintaining some cleanup level in that zone of exposure or perhaps specified somewhat below that zone of exposure to ensure that the zone of exposure is at below those levels. How you actually do that in detail at a particular site is certainly an important issue, and there is quite a variety of ways to evaluate whether we're going to look at a sample that is averaged over the top foot to compare to this cleanup level, or whether we look at the bottom of that layer through a core, a bottom of the biologically active zone, or maybe even a zone just below that. There are a variety of ways this has been done, but they're usually based on bulk sediment levels that must be achieved either initially or for all time, even after, for example, groundwater upwelling has caused some migration of contaminants, levels that must be maintained within the cap. Slide 26, we're starting into the details of actual construction and some of the issues associated with placement of those multiple layers. The first thing that comes to mind is the geotechnical considerations. I mentioned before the soft sediments. Oftentimes we are placing over soft sediments, and so the bearing capacity of those sediments becomes an issue. Slopes is also of concern, and although sand in principle could be placed on a relatively steep slope, almost 1 to 2, Generally, we are trying to build caps that are much more gently sloped than that to ensure their stability. And then we also have to concern ourselves with the stability of the sediment deposits underneath the cap. If we're placing on a slope in particular, placement of a cap may be the straw that breaks the camel's back and causes the sediment layer underlying it to slough off. And these are issues that have to be addressed. Mike's going to be talking a lot more about the cap construction and placement messes and issues that might arise during those, so I'll defer that to him. Slide 27 talks about the upper layers of a cap. Let's say we were able to, because of the strength of the sediments, because of the way that we're going to place it, for example, over very soft sediments, we tend to try to place in layers, relatively thin lifts of sand, in this case, so that we do not stress the bearing capacity or overcome that bearing capacity in a single lift. We place in a thin layer, allow the bearing capacity to increase as a result of consolidation and strengthening of that layer and also due to intermixing, and then we come back with additional layers. But what do we place on top? And one of the things that I often try to get people to look at when we're trying to think of remedies for a river is ultimately what do you want the river to look like? Oftentimes I don't think we do look at that, but especially if you're going to place material like capping material in a river, you want to be able to ask yourself, what would I like the bottom to look like? I have an opportunity to change it. What would I like it in terms of depth, substrate characteristics, granularity, etc.? And so always encourage people to exactly do that, to figure out what you might want on top of a cap. But a lot of our discussion will be focused, since that's clearly a site-specific issue and one that I'm not very skilled at responding to anyway, a lot of our discussion here in the next few slides is going to be focused on how do we ensure that that cap stays in place. And that comes down to that layer immediately below that, that armoring layer at the top of our cap. Before doing that, I just thought I'd include a picture that a person that I've been working with in the past had drawn as a potential cap habitat layer. And the dark blue line in this particular figure shows a cap layer, and it can be buried fairly deeply beneath the overlying habitat layer in particular instances. So, for example, here we have some emerging wetland as well as some debris to encourage certain kind of game fish out into the water body itself. But, of course, it also illustrates with the buoy marker to the right-hand side that some institutional controls must be in place if we're going to put this sort of habitat improvement. One of the advantages of pushing this cap, if you look closer to the left-hand side, that's buried beneath this emergent wetland, it's relatively deep. In this case, it's actually about 5 feet above, or 5 feet below grade. And one of the advantages there is that our erosion resistance is not as strict as if we tried to place this directly on a cap directly on a bank. A bank is often subject to waves and other erosive forces that are more difficult. So burying it slightly at that end allows us, one, to build perhaps a more robust habitat layer, but also helps us avoid some significant armoring. So let's talk about the erosive resistance, and for that I'm going to start with slide 29. First of all, as is often used to determine what sort of erosive forces have occurred in the past, is radionuclide data. In this case, most commonly, cesium-137, lead-210. Cesium-137 is only from above-ground nuclear testing, and so it gives an indication in the early 1950s when this testing first was began. We see its presence, basically its presence tagged post-1954 sediments. And there was a peak in the early 60s when this above-ground testing was at its peak, and that can also help you identify a particular age level of sediments. And so in this particular picture here, we have it's from the Anacostia River, and we have, I think, a fairly classic profile of deep sediments showing early 1950s, at least as deep as some 25 or so centimeters into the sediments, a peak that's somewhat higher than that, that is higher up in the sediment column, and those two that bottom level in the peak give rise to an estimate of a depositional rate that's less than a centimeter a year, and fairly appears to be fairly uniform. And that's borne out as well by lead-210, which is showing a decrease as we go into the sediments as a result of radioactive decay. And a nice, relatively uniform profile here showed, again, a deposition rate that's consistent with what we saw at the cesium. Those bits of information are commonly used to say that this is an area that had been net depositional, at least over the last 50-some-odd years. There hasn't been any significant erosive events that have significantly or substantially disrupted the sediment profile. Just at the top, the beryllium-7 is a short-lived isotope, and so it indicates the degree of surface-sediment interaction with the overlying water, probably due to bioturbation. We're just looking at that surface layer, as I mentioned before, can be fairly thin, in this case only about 4 centimeters. Well, that might indicate the overall stability of the system, whether it is stable or not. But let's say that we have information on the shear stresses that we might be, that the cap might be subject to. How do we design that into the cap? And on slide 30, we begin with that, just a relationship between the shear stress relative to the slope of a river and hydraulic radius of the river, just a recognizing that kind of the key parameters there. Slide 31, starting looking into a little bit more detail, one of the things that can be useful at a site if we're trying to figure out whether it's going to be stable, not just based on the last 50 years, but over the past or into the next several hundred years, do we expect to see this system stable or not? And one of the tools that you can use for that is something that's shown here, is that if we look at a plot in similar sort of systems, and we look at how large is our contributing drainage area, and we can get an estimate of the peak amount of water in a given climatic situation of how much water that might mean will be contributed to a particular stream. And the bounding curve might give you an indication of what an extreme peak discharge might be. On slide 32, we then try to take that peak discharge and what that might mean in terms of critical shear stress and relate that back as to how large a stone or sand or whatever do we need at the top of a cap to control the migration in the cap. And that's what this slide is just showing, that we can understand non-cohesive material stability quite well. Slide 33 just summarizes some of the other criteria that it's important to recognize, that we can't put coarse material right on top of fine-grained material. Sometimes we need some filtering layers in between. And these are standard Corps of Engineer criteria that can be helpful in defining those filtering layers. We often use a model, and the discussion of that starts on slide 34. We often use a model to try to predict the chemical migration through a cap and how protective that cap may be. And there's a variety of approaches. I'm not going to talk in great detail about the cap models that are applicable, but there are a variety of models, from very simple models that are, give you a scoping relationship, gives you a screening relationship. I often like to use to look at steady state, namely ask the question, if I go forever subject to conservative assumptions, will this cap be protective if I can keep it in place? Or I might look at transient models over time. How long is it going to take before I begin to see any migration of any significance to the top of a cap? Or I could do it in a more sophisticated manner with numerical models, and that allow us to deal with much more variation in parameters and conditions. Slide 35 summarizes some of the common assumptions we make in these models. We typically assume, for example, that the concentration in the underlying sediment is constant, that there are absolutely no reactive fate processes that will, over time, reduce that concentration. We often, in the absence of the numerical models, we often even assume that the mass that migrates up into the cap doesn't even change that concentration. So those are conservative assumptions, but they're often done for the screening level models. I mentioned before the consolidation, whether that's going to be a significant issue or not depends on whether the cap has any degree of sorption capacity or not. And it's important when we consider this. A lot of the way we do these models is just simple one-dimensional. That is, we're looking at one-dimensional prediction of everything that the cap is going to do. And it's important to recognize that a cap isn't one-dimensional. It's two-dimensional. It has a large aerial extent. And it's also important to recognize that if we lose a certain portion of that cap through, if there's erosion in a small area, we have to ask ourselves whether that's important relative to the overall effectiveness of the cap. It may be that erosion in small areas may not have a significant impact on the overall effectiveness of the cap at all. Slide 36 lists some of the approaches that have been used in numerical models, and the only advantage that these really provide is that there really are the same types of tools as in the simpler models, but they allow you to evaluate a variety of different conditions, multiple layers, heterogeneity of various sorts, and that's the advantage that are provided by the numerical models. Slide 37 just kind of illustrates a cartoon, basically, although it is a simulation of a flux showing a strongly solid associated contaminant that is migrating through a cap. In this case, we're talking about a very long period of time before it would migrate through this cap under advection and diffusion, both occurring. And the numerical model might give you, or a transient model might give you, the behavior as a function of time, whereas the steady state model is just going to try to estimate what it might be at long time. Some of the key parameters that are used to evaluate and run those models are shown on slide 38. How fast does bioturbation mix the surface layer of the sediment, which is the first little section? What sort of seepage velocity might be important? As noted there, if we had a centimeter per year type advection velocity, that is groundwater upwelling velocity, then we're looking at upwelling probably being about the same sort of speed of migration as molecular diffusion, which is very slow. And this is for a moderately sorbing, like a mid-range PAH, like pyrene. But if we had upwelling that might be of the order of 1 to 100 meters per year, then we're talking about, for that same sort of contaminant, we're talking about upwelling that's as fast as bioturbation. And that's a relatively fast process. But bioturbation is generally only limited to the upper few inches, whereas if it were throughout the cap, we're talking about potential compromising of that cap as a result of the upwelling at those sort of velocities, 1 to 100 meters per year. So those can be important. We often assume, moving down to fraction organic carbon, the cap itself is often very little organic carbon if we're using sand. But over time, the surface might contain more organic carbon and look more like the sediment that's around it. And the implications for sorption in that layer or even accumulation of contaminants in that layer should be considered. Now on slide 39, and then the last few slides, we're touching on the issues that problems and kind of current issues. How do we deal with problems that aren't within our standard scheme of things relative to sandy cap design? And one is just extremely soft sediments. How do we place material appropriately to deal with sediments that have absolutely no bearing strength at all or very close to that? Surprisingly, again, even with sand, we can often place, if we place in thin enough lifts, we can do quite well, and there's some good examples of that. A number of sites now are, because there's a real problem in dealing with NAPL-contaminated sediments, it's certainly not something that's easily manageable by any active remedial method. And so if we consider capping, what is the effect of NAPL on a cap design? Can we have a cap that will control NAPL? And in some cases, I think that's the case. In some cases, the placement will disturb the NAPL. And gas is very similar. If there is accumulation of gas in the sediments, the cap can certainly cause that to be mobilized. That may not be a problem, but especially in conjunction with NAPL, that may be a very big issue. Groundwater upwelling, I've already touched on several times. The seepage of groundwater upwelling can be an issue in areas where that's very important, and especially for more soluble contaminants. And then there's still a question as to what we should use as a design flow, and that depends upon how protective we need to be at a particular site. Do we need to be protecting against what particular situation? or what year return or what period return flow are we concerned with, 500-year, 100-year? Or is there other limitations like ice that in some areas, well, only one area that I know of, that ice may be the limiting factor, and ice breakup and the development of ice dams could be the controlling factor, and wasn't necessarily viewed, at least until that happened, that this was really the design flow. The design prior to that was probably focused more on hydraulics, simple water hydraulics, but that's in some cases that may not be the issue. And then the last few slides I'm going to devote to active capping. What are the situations, which is a current issue in cap design, what do we do in situations where sand isn't going to be sufficient? And slide 40 is the first of those. It's really just defining active caps. And we're just looking for a material that has greater effectiveness than sand. It's not just a passive containment layer, but it might encourage either treatment, like degradation, of the contaminants that are passing through a cap or potentially even beneath a cap, although less likely, or to sequester contaminants that might migrate through a cap. Slide 41 just lists some of the materials that have been proposed or used for NAPL, the non-aqueous phase liquids, the oily materials, organoclays in the last year or two have shown great success in particular sites and containing oily contaminated sediment. Other things that have been proposed, however, are things like activated carbon to control organic contaminant, things like apatite, phosphates to control metals, zero van iron to encourage a reductive dechlorination, which might be most useful in something like a chlorinated solvent that is in a groundwater plume that's moving into water. And then more speculatively, there's some work ongoing with biopolymers to just see what they can do and how stable they might be. If we're looking at containment methods, if we move on to slide 42, we're looking at sequestration. And here's the real advantage of adding these active materials. If we look at the top left slide where there's just the diffusion, it's a model simulated result because my graduate students don't live the 10,000 years, or at least I can't keep them in the lab that long. But if we look at the model-generated results in sand, we're looking at this particular scenario, a cap being protected for somewhat around 100 years, and then there is at least a maximum flux. It may be that flux isn't significant, but it could be a problem. But if we have a retardant in there, we can stretch that out, reduce the maximum flux, and reduce the time or increase the time that it takes before that occurs significantly. So that's the advantage of placing an active cap. And just to illustrate for the organoclays, here's a figure of some work that we've done looking at gas-associated NAPL release. And the blue line is from the sediment itself as a result of passage of gas. And then the purple line is a reduction in flux, reduction in mass released, or in this case, actually, as a result of a very thin sand cap. And then the bottom line shows how effectively the organoclays just reduces the contaminant release effectively entirely. And again, very thin layer in this case. Slide 44, just a placeholder for a project that I'm leading in the Anacostia River in Washington, D.C., where we looked at a variety of materials and placed some in the river as a demonstration of acting capping technologies. And we were able to demonstrate that you could place some of these materials with conventional equipment, and the monitoring, the effectiveness is ongoing. The particular material, these are all materials we considered, the particular materials we placed were the alkyl block, which is a material to help control, a low permeability material to help control seepage. A coke is a cheap adsorbent for organic contaminants. An apatite soil to help control metals, and those were the three things that were actually placed in the river. Slide 45 recognizes that the fundamental concerns of these active capping materials are the difficulty of introducing these materials into sediment. Sometimes they may not have physical characteristics that are as optimum as sand in terms of placement. They're also costly, so if we're not able to place them very well, that can have very negative consequences. If we can't place them very well and they're very expensive to boot, we see them floating downstream, for example. Sometimes for things like zero-valent iron in the aqueous environment, we'd expect that to be oxidized relatively quickly and may not have effectiveness for very long. So those are all concerns. And then anytime we're trying to use some sort of active cap over sand, we're potentially erase the cost benefits of the capping and in situ treatment, and it causes a reassessment as to whether it's appropriate. Now, the final thing that I wanted to point to is something that we used in the Anacostia to place material that weren't very easily placed in the river. It was a reactive core mat working with a company, Setco, out of Chicago, Illinois. But this has the advantage of being able to place material where you want it in a thin, active layer. And so it has some potential for managing some of those concerns, the top three concerns listed on that slide. Slide 46 just shows those mats as we did in used them on the Anacostia. Slide 47 shows how we placed them, essentially unrolled them on the river, and that worked quite well, and other people have more used them more recently with different approaches and had success as well. And then slide 48 talks a little bit about the cost of those. And this is just one means of trying to manage the difficulty of placing high-value materials that might not have positive physical characteristics in the river. Now, those last few slides were a summary of some of the ways that you could use active capping, some of the materials you might use. But I hope that if you go back over the entire set of slides, that I've convinced you that there certainly sediment capping is a potentially cost-effective means. It's part of the toolbox for sediment remediation, and it should be considered for implementation along with monitored natural recovery and dredging at particular sites. I believe we're going to turn, well, first of all, to a question-and-answer period, and then we'll turn to Mike for his discussion of how you might actually implement some of these concepts. Kelly, yeah. I'll turn it back to you.
Yeah, thank you, Danny, for that presentation. As Danny alluded to, we're going to have a Q&A now for the next, so we've a lot of time for the next 10 minutes or so before we go on to Mike. And so those on the phone, feel free to unmute your phone and ask questions towards Danny. And while you do that, I'll ask one question that was submitted online, Danny. The question is, are there any settlement data, that is, change in the bottom elevation, available for sites where caps have been placed? If so, what is a typical range of settlement?
Well, does vary quite a bit depending on how soft and how much consolidation you might see in underlying sediment. But it has often been the case in places where capping has been conducted thus far that the sediment is consolidating significantly less than the thickness of the cap. That is, if we had a 2-foot layer cap, it's often seen, as we did in Anacostia, for example, we had a 1-foot cap and had 2 to 3 inches of consolidation of the underlying sediment. It'd be pretty common to see something like a 2-foot cap giving rise to 6 inches of consolidation. But there certainly are sites where the material's a lot softer and there will be significantly more consolidation, especially as we look to sites where we're trying to cap now that are dealing with much softer materials. And in some of those cases, we can see consolidation up to the same thickness of the cap. So it can be quite a bit. But in general, it's been over, say, typical sediments that we've done in the past, perhaps 1/4 to 1/5 of the thickness of the cap material placed, again, focused on sand.
Okay. Well, great. Is there any questions on the phone people would like to ask right now?
Yeah, this is Steve Johnson from Region 5. You mentioned there were other sites that had been, where capping had been used, where the underlying substrate was basically a zero strength, something like a thick liquid or something like that. What sites are they? Do you have?
Well, probably the first one in that category would be a demonstration capping project in Soda Lake in Wyoming.
Right, I know that one.
Very, very soft material. I would say that most of the other sites that come immediately to mind are things that where capping is under consideration right now, and so not a lot of, I can't think of any other really good examples that come to mind at this instant where it's already been completely implemented.
All right, thanks.
This is Karen Keeley from Region 10, and we did a thin layer cap at Ketchikan Pulp Company up in Alaska, and they had very, very soft sediments. So it depends what you meant by cap, but that's another site.
Mm-hmm. Also, Pine Street, Danny, was pretty soft there.
Oh, that's right. Pine Street is definitely a very, very soft system, probably the outlier among the systems that we're looking at right now. In some places, there was as much as 10-foot thick layer of basically soup. And there is concerns about the cap moving material around at this stage, and so the final word isn't out in that case. But that is certainly the extreme of this, what's been done so far.
Hi, this is Kathy in Region 7. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hey, good.
Probably the outlier among the... Oh, I got an echo.
Okay, this is Kathy, Region 7. You haven't mentioned plants yet, either emergent macrophytes or any other kind of plants growing in or out of the cap. Do you have any information on that?
No, the only place that we've encountered is where where we're looking at the nearshore area, where we're concerned about what that habitat value of this, the upper layer might be, and that's the only place that I've mentioned that. I'd have to say that in almost every case where I'm working, until you get to that nearshore area, there's not been an expectation that we're going to have submerged aquatic vegetation. I'm certainly not the person to ask as to how to do that or what to do with it. And in our cases, again, it's only been in the habitat layer on top of what we would consider our isolation layer.
Well, we'll go online for a few more questions. One question is presented was, how do you ensure uniform placement of a very thin reactive cap, few inches, so that you can obtain complete coverage of the target area and attain a desired thickness in most places?
That's that was one of the reasons that I brought up the reactive core mat. If we were really looking for a very thin layer of, let's say, 1 to 2 inches, it is difficult to do if we're going to try to do it by broadcasting. It is conceivable in certain situations you might be able to place material and then distribute it by raking across the bottom, et cetera. And in terms of your ability to do that, probably depends a lot on the contractor and the physical characteristics of the material and how closely you're able to monitor that using modern methods of real-time feedback on bathymetry. But if you, without that degree of control, I think the reactive core mat, and if you have material that doesn't have physical characteristics that allow it to be settled quickly to the bottom or easily to the bottom, then something like a reactive core mat may be the only way to achieve a thin layer of placement that is, that you can assure that a certain thickness and ensure that you have placement of the material that you're desiring.
Another question submitted online is, are you aware of any sites where AquaBlock has been used for pH-contaminated sediments?
I am not, and although if the concern is the migration of either high or low pH pore water, it certainly could be used to do that. It would conceivably, at least in principle, it could be used to divert the groundwater away from the high pH area, and groundwater will still migrate, but it would divert it away, or potentially, depending upon the particular situation, it could potentially divert it away from the area that is causing the high or low pH in that groundwater. You do have to be careful with this because, again, the groundwater is going to find a way through, and so it's only of advantage to the extent that the AquaBlock or what other material will divert groundwater away from whatever is the source area.
Okay. And then another question online is, how do you address prop wash and cap design?
There are procedures that the Corps of Engineers have developed that is focused on bank protection, and the capping guidance document does employ those approaches. I think they are quite useful, and I think the bank protection design guidance is, in fact, conservative relative to subaqueous caps in general. So I think this can be a very useful tool. one of the difficulties is often deciding what you're going to employ as your design criteria, just as in armoring for storm events. Often it's the question, what storm event are you going to use? And in this case, if we've got relatively shallow water, let's say 3, 4, 5 feet, and if I have, if I'm going to use as my design basis two 200 horsepower Mercury outboards that suddenly go full throttle, it's going to be hard to design that cap, at least with rock that isn't large enough to eat the propellers at the same time. At the same time, I'm not sure that that's an appropriate design criteria because of, keep in mind that a lot of this would be a localized event. While it's common during piers, you probably do need to design that in piers if you need to maintain cover. If you're looking out in an area where you don't normally have continuous, common, regular traffic like that, where you do have that going to full blast on two 200 horsepower Mercury outboards, then I don't think it's necessarily a good design criteria.
Okay. Is there anyone on the phones who would like to ask one more question or two before we go off to Mike Plumero and the second half of the presentation? All right. Well, thank you, Danny.
This is Scott Hanson with Region 5. My question is more on the debris, I guess. I have a site, the sediments are contaminated, but there's some places that have got 4 to 6 feet of wood debris on top of it. We're talking wood chips, you know, telephone poles, you name it. It's like a variety of wood waste. And is there any sites that you know of that have dealt with capping that might have major amounts of wood waste on that? And some of the wood waste even has contamination in it too, so.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, well, we all, I think we're aware, and we'll hear a lot more, I think, next week about some of the issues of trying to remove that.
Yeah.
And, you know, effectively, you've got to shake off, you end up shaking off all the sediment into the water column when you try to remove that waste, which is a problem if we were trying to remove it. For capping, in principle, you have a pretty good ability to respond to that because you don't have to move that debris. And if you're using something like sand, an unconsolidated material, that granular material, it will tend to form around whatever debris you're trying to place. It just has to be thicker. Probably the worst, the poster child for debris in my mind is also that Pine Street Canal. And there were old barges that for historical reasons, there was a desire not to remove those barges. And they effectively protruded out of the sediment 5, 6, 7 feet, and they were just capped. And again, it appears to be quite effective, and that portion of the remedy is quite effective and not even some of the concerns of relative to what I mentioned before about this extremely soft cool of napple that might be moving around underneath the cap. So there's an example of where debris capping was placed on really quite extensive debris, if you will, something that protruded out quite extensively into the overlying water.
Well, thank you. With that, I think, for the sake of time, we're going to move on now to Mike Plumero and this part of the presentation. Again, we have Danny's email as well as its hot link on this presentation, so feel free to follow up with additional questions. So with that, everybody should be on slide B1, and from that, Mike will take the second half of the presentation.
Okay. Danny, I appreciate you being right on schedule. That's great. You know, I try to do the same thing. Once again, this presentation is oriented toward what I've titled capping operations, but it really is related to how we go about implementing a capping remedy. If you go to slide 2, that is an outline of what I'm going to try to cover with this. Once again, implementation is what we're calling to include the placement of the cap or the construction of the cap. And There have been so many ways that these caps have been constructed over the years, and I'm going to show you a lot of examples of those. And what I'll also try to do is point out the processes that we have to be worried about when we select an approach, or we select a contractor or evaluate a contractor suggested approach on how to place a cap. And I'll be showing you a lot of different equipment. Also point out the need for, you know, planning for how the operation will be carried out. And I'll touch on monitoring and management as well. If you look now at slide three, the first point that I wanted to make in this presentation was that you can't look at cap placement issues in isolation from the cap design. They're very strongly related, and they're related really in two ways to one another. If you look at defining cap design as the type of cap material that you might use and how thick those layers might be, obviously your design is going to influence what type of equipment you might select or at least plan on for the placement of those layers. We can't place very thin layers, for instance, with, you know, big buckets, big clamshell buckets, very effectively. And you can't place things like armor stone with hydraulic dredges. So, you know, that's going to strongly influence the type of equipment and placement technique that you might do. The design will greatly influence that. In the reverse fashion, your design can be great, but if you, you know, have a problem in the field in placing that layer, perhaps placing it at a uniform thickness or the proper thickness, obviously those layers are not going to be as effective as your design would call for. So we've got a very strong relationship between the design and the placement, and one sort of influences the other. And in fact, some of the things we look at in placement are, you know, some people would construe as part of the design. If you look at now slide four, these are the processes that are important in implementing a capping remedy. And I'm going to touch on what each one of them, you know, involves and why they're important. Already in Dan's presentation, he mentioned, you know, control sources first. I can't get that message across strong enough. It appears time and time again when we talk about either dredging remedies or capping remedies. But with a capping remedy, you know, what we're worried about is recontamination of the cap surface. And if you don't have those sources controlled, that's going to show up in your monitoring program, because you will be monitoring long-term with capping remedies. The equipment selection involves consideration of a number of things. Resuspension during placement, you know, we often think about resuspension in the context of environmental dredging, but it is an issue for capping, although I'll point out it's not as important as it is for dredging, actually. Slope stability, bearing capacity, these are things that we've touched on briefly in some of Dan's design discussion. Same thing for mixing, consolidation, and this other last thing on the list, operational capabilities, is something that he didn't touch on, I don't believe, and I'll point out why that's important. Going on to slide five, I've got a couple of slides that tick off the main things we do know about capping resuspension. We've studied resuspension of contaminated sediments during environmental dredging operations quite a bit and for you know, a good number of years, and we know some things about how different dredging techniques and different types of dredging equipment resuspend sediments, but we haven't paid too much attention to how cap placement operations resuspend sediment. We've only collected data at a few sites on this process. We have found a couple of things. First of all, we have found that in a comparative way, there's less potential for resuspension than for dredging the same sediment under the same site conditions. There have been a couple of sites where we have been monitoring resuspension due to dredging and resuspension due to cap placement at the same site. And so we've come to that, you know, obvious conclusion based on that data, and your intuition would tell you the same thing. And just as we can control resuspension of sediments during dredging, we also can consider control measures to manage resuspension during capping, although I've never seen that actually done at the site. Some capping has been done behind silt curtains, but it's not really as much of a concern for capping as it is for dredging. And I'd point out, too, that the only real field data that we have collected on this process of capping induced resuspension was collected by EPA Cincinnati Lab as one of their research projects, and they did that in cooperation with some work the Corps did at one site I know of, and have also planned to study that at a few other sites in the future as well. I'm going to go on to slide six now. This is a little bit more on capping resuspension. We do have data. This is a list of the sites where we do have some data on resuspension. You can see that they encompass a fairly wide range of site conditions. Once again, no significant releases as far as contaminant releases were observed during cap placement at these sites. Another thing that's very important, I mentioned that we do have some predictive capability for evaluating resuspension of sediments due to dredging, but there is no predictive model or technique that I'm aware of where we could make a before-the-fact prediction of how much resuspension of sediment we might see due to a certain capping operation or capping placement operation. Going on now to slide seven, I'm changing now gears a little bit and looking at slope stability. This is a placement issue that has two different concerns. The first one, and Danny alluded to this in some of the information that he presented, is how steep a slope can we place a cap on? He alluded to the fact that sand will take some angle of repose, and theoretically it might be like 1 to 1.88, but generally we haven't had that much luck placing sand on real steep slopes, but we can't easily place it on slopes, say, one vertical on three horizontal or flatter, no problem with that. But this is a real issue. It's become a real issue at sites like the Palos Verdes Shelf, where we've got a sloping bottom, and global slope stability is really, really important. But the other aspect of slope stability relates to the edge effect. You can see the little diagram there on the right that shows we have a contaminated sediment deposit and a cap over that. And we've got to be concerned about overlapping the edge of where we see the boundary of the active remediation, and we want to overlap that with some stable slope. And this is not too much of an issue for most caps because most of these caps are fairly thin, a foot, 2 feet, maybe up to 3 feet or so. But if you start looking at things like armor layers and a robust cap that might require multiple layers that, get out there 2-3 feet thick, this can be an issue, and it does increase the area of capping. Slide eight. This is the, we've seen a couple of questions already from Dan's presentation about placement of caps on soft sediments. And this is the golden rule, is place to avoid displacement. The capping placement rule of thumb is place it in thin layers. Gradually build up your required cap thickness by placing multiple thin layers. And how thin can we place? I'm going to show you some examples where we have placed discrete capping layers of sandy material in 1 to 2 inch lifts. And generally, what we've seen in these designs is it's not very desirable to plan on placing more than about 6 inches of cap material in a lift. We don't want to try to place 12, 18, 24 inches of sand in a single lift, because we will see, as I go through my slides, you'll see why, we will see the potential for displacement of the contaminated sediment and overturning or bearing capacity failures. So the rule of thumb, keep in mind, I'll probably touch on this several times, is place it thin, gradually build it up. Slide nine. This is another slide related to bearing capacity. It shows you a couple of, actually, these are sediment profile images where they've used acoustic instruments to look at a slice down through a deposit of, actually, in this case, dredged material. These two images were from Boston Harbor, where some mildly contaminated dredged material was placed in a series of constructed, contained a quiet disposal pits, if you want to look at it that way, depressions that were constructed in the bottom of the harbor. And the darker surface image you see is the image of a sand cap that was placed over this fairly soft material. The material was dredged with a hopper dredge, so in some cases dredged with a mechanical dredge, placed in this pit. It was fairly soft material. and an attempt was made to put about a 2 to 3 foot thickness of sand on top of it. And that sand was placed in a variety of ways, mostly with a hopper dredge. And you can see in the upper image, you can see what are called intrusions or diapirs, I believe is the title of what they were seeing there, where some of the soft sediment squeezed out up through the cap. This was the first pit that they tried this on. And they were trying to put the sand layer down fairly quickly. And they fast learned that they needed to attempt to spread the sand. And they were able to do this with the hopper dredge placements. And you can see in the lower image another pit that was capped later using the spreading approach and very little evidence of any intrusions up through the cap. This is important, especially if you're trying to place a fairly thick cap. And once again, it shows why that cap placement golden rule is so important. You've got to place the cap in thin layers, build it up over a wide area, and build up the thickness that you need by multiple thin layers. Going on slide 10, this slide shows you more of the geotechnical basis of what I've been saying about the thin layer placement. This upper diagram is the classic geotechnical engineering problem of a building footing on a soil, and it indicates how soil fails in a bearing capacity failure mode. It's like a punching failure as that footing is pressed into the soil by the weight of the structure. It actually pushes soil out to the side and up around it, which is the classic bearing capacity failure mode. In our situation with placing a cap, what we're interested in is what's shown in the lower diagram, and these diagrams were constructed originally by Anchor Environmental to illustrate some of the projects they were working on. It shows that we want to place the cap in thin layers and in uniform layers, layers of fairly uniform thickness, and avoid a differential height of cap material being placed at any given instant. Once again, it goes back to this idea we don't want to try to place a cap 24 inches at a time because of the potential for a bearing capacity failure. We want to place the cap so that we avoid this excessive difference in thickness, and that's what actually applies this type of a punching failure mode to the sediment below it. So, and there are some calculations that can be done based on estimated shear strengths of the soft sediment below, where you can determine what that maximum differential thickness would be for a given sediment characteristic. Going on now to slide 11, this is the process of mixing, and Danny mentioned mixing as one of the considerations for cap design in his talk. This shows these pictures out to the right are some sediment profile images of sand layers being placed on fairly soft sediment. They're actually from the Palos Verdes Shelf project, but they were the cleanest pictures I could show you with a sand layer on top of a fine grain sediment. A couple of messages here is that first, with conventional capping, where we're placing a granular cap material like a sand on a fine sediment, you will have some mixing, and how much that mixing would be would depend on, of course, how soft the sediment would be and how fast and how aggressively you attempt to place the capping material. And Danny alluded to the fact it could be an inch, it could be 2 inches, it could be up to 6 inches, depending on those factors. The message I have for you is that this will occur. You can consider this in designing your cap. The cap can be designed such that you would assume that there would be a certain thickness of mixing, and that could be even accounted for in your design for chemical isolation where you run your predictive models and things like this. So plan for it. And there's no real need to say that, you know, you will take extreme measures to avoid it if you have the luxury of assuming that you will have a portion of your sand layer mixed with your contaminated sediment. The cap still can be constructed and can still be effective. Going on to slide 12, consolidation. Once again, this is an issue for design as well. One thing that I would add to the discussion that we've already had on consolidation is that it's very difficult, unless you actually go out and take samples of the cap with cores, to determine what might be consolidation versus what might be, say, erosion, or what might be a mixing of two layers that would result in a net decrease in all the layer thicknesses that you might see before and after capping. Once again, consider consolidation in your monitoring program. Consider consolidation in the design of your cap. And as you look at post-cap conditions in the long term with long-term monitoring, consider the fact that consolidation will occur. And just because you see a decrease in the elevation of the bottom, it doesn't mean that that cap is going away. It could mean simply that the whole system is consolidating and moving downward slightly. Going now to slide 13, this is a slide that illustrates, again, a couple of things about operational capabilities. We are concerned about several things that I would classify under the term operational factors or processes. First is the ability to place thin lifts. If we want to place a very thin layer of material, it is difficult to do that with certain types of equipment, and we are hard-pressed to be able to place, say, 1 inch of sand uniformly over a large area. But we can attempt to place, you know, thin lifts and build up a 6-inch thickness of sand fairly confidently. As opposed to the ability to place thin lifts, that's one issue. The ability to place uniform lifts is another issue altogether. And then also, there's another factor, the ability to monitor this placement. There's been a movement at a couple of sites toward considering, you know, fairly thin isolation caps. And this is an issue that's come up, especially if we're interested, as Danny pointed out, that we want the chemical isolation layer to be there, to stay there, to remain effective over very long time periods. Meaning that we would like to go out and monitor that occasionally, you know, at some time frequency and see that that layer is still there and still doing its job. You can't go out and find that layer if it's only, you know, 1 inch thick or maybe 2 inches thick. It's got to have some thickness that can be found with coring and can be identified and can be confirmed that it is still remaining clean. So that is an issue that I would also throw under this operational capability category. Going on to slide 14, I'm beginning now a series of slides that will show various types of placement equipment and approaches. I've touched on the idea that you can use conventional equipment like hopper dredges or pipelines or barges to place cap materials. And we're talking in this internet seminar primarily about in situ capping for purposes of sediment remediation. Some of these more conventional equipment types like hopper dredges or pipelines or barges have been used for also dredge material capping projects. Usually the caps are thicker for dredge material capping projects because usually that material is coming from another dredging project and something's got to be done with it anyway. The trend on in situ capping is to try to get the caps as thin as possible because, for one thing, it costs more to put thicker caps, but also we run against this water depth issue as well. So thinner caps usually are the trend for the in situ caps. And to do that, you know, we're looking usually at spreading methods. Also, we have some submerged discharge approaches too that are workable. And in selecting the equipment and the approach to place a cap, this is a list of the things that are generally the most important considerations. First, geotechnical properties. In other words, how soft the material might be and how, what its geotechnical properties are. And keep in mind, too, that most of these fine-grained sediments that we're evaluating capping for, they are going to be softer at the surface, more fluffy at the surface. As you go down in the sediment profile, they're going to be, you know, higher densities. There'll be higher densities. And once again, this is, you know, everything to take into account when you think about things like mixing layers and, you know, how thick those layers are going to be and what type of approach and equipment you might use to place the cap. Another thing is the thickness of the cap component. If we're going to be placing very thin layers, say you want to place, fairly thin layer of sand, followed by a fairly thin layer of armoring, gravel, or something on top of it, that's going to really influence the type of equipment that you will use. In contrast to maybe a design that calls for placing a, say, 2 foot thick cap, you might use a completely different type of equipment or even a larger size of equipment, say a larger bucket size or something like that. Also, water depth is quite important. We can you know, rain sediment or rain capping material like a sandy material down through a very deep water depth. We've done a successful cap placement at a pilot project at Palos Verdes Shelf where we capped and successfully constructed a cap at a water depth of 60 to 65 meters. So that's been done at a very deep water depth here in the U.S. But if you're dealing with shallow water, of course, on the other extreme, you've got to have equipment that can get in there and operate in shallow water. And I'll show you some examples of that as we go through the next slides coming up. Also, hydrodynamics, depending on the energy and wave climate in the area that you're working, that might influence your placement equipment. And, we've already talked about the importance of slopes. I'm going to be doing things a little differently if I'm going to be placing a cap on a fairly steep slope than if I'm, working on a flat bottom. Going on now to slide 16. This is the first in a whole series of slides I'm going to show you on different ways that caps have been constructed, different types of approaches that have been used. This first one is from a project out in the Puget Sound area called Denny Way. This is a combined sewer overflow that had been contaminated with PCBs out from the overflow discharge. You can see that picture up in the upper left where the discharge came out in Puget Sound. And this was the first instance where a cap had been placed using what I would call a spreading technique for mechanically dredged sediment. And in fact, you're going to see probably several examples in this list of projects in Puget Sound, and I will have to say that Region 10 and the Seattle District of the Corps of Engineers have really, sort of led the way, in my opinion, about using different approaches and different ways of constructing caps, and that's why I've got several examples of that in here. This had never been done before. This is one of the older projects in the history that we go back with capping, where a mechanically dredged sediment from a navigation dredging project was used to construct a cap, and you can see that what the method that they used was lateral movement of a split hull barge. Usually these split hull barges are towed with a cable. In this case, they towed the barge of dredged sand from the navigation project to the site, gradually opened this split hull barge over a time interval of about 30 to 60 minutes. And while they were gradually opening it, that tug laterally pushed that barge across the site and sort of rained out the sand over the site. They were attempting to put a cap of 3 feet thick, 3 feet thickness over this area. And I think that there was some variability there. I think the thinnest it was about a foot and a half. The thickest it may have been about 4.5 feet. And of course, one problem they have doing this, and you can imagine this is true, is you have sand in this barge, and you start to open it up, it will start to rain out. But once it gets to a certain point, the bridging action sort of lets go, and then a lot of it falls out at one time. So that's one difficulty in using this particular method. But this was the first experiment spreading sand this way, and it was generally successful. This is another project here in slide 17 from Puget Sound, and this is the Simpson Craft Tacoma project where a very thick sand habitat cap was placed over a contaminated area hydraulically. What you're looking at in these pictures is not a dredge, it's actually the end of a dredge discharge pipe, and it's using what is called a sandbox. The sandbox is you see the wider view in the lower picture with a little spud barge there and the end of the discharge pipe spilling into the sandbox. It's really a heavy timber grate, and the momentum of the hydraulic discharge hits the grate and allows the sand to just vertically fall through the grate, and of course this little spud barge is used to maneuver the sandbox over the area that you're capping, and in this way they were able to build up the cap thickness across the area they were dealing with. And that is clean sand, by the way. It doesn't look that clean, but it is clean sand. Got a little bit of fines in it. Slide 18 shows, and I did not see this in the flesh, but this is one example of a capping project in fairly deep water. I think this was even deeper than 60 meters that we did at Palos Verdes at this particular project in Norway. But you see on the left the arrangement where capping material was brought to a barge, reslurried at the site and dropped down through a trimmy pipe A trimmy is a term used for a vertical pipe, like you place concrete. They call that process a trimmy placement. But at the end of the pipe is a what looks like a sort of a inverted funnel. It's what we would call a diffuser, a submerged diffuser, where the material as it comes down through the vertical discharge pipe, it enters this diffuser that widens out and allows the material to be discharged in a radial pattern. And what it does essentially is it reduces the velocity. The exit velocity out of that diffuser can be on the order of 1/15 of the velocity going through the vertical pipe. And so it really reduces velocities and allows the material to be spread out in a fairly gentle way. And this has been used, as I said, in the Norway project. Also has been used in a couple of projects in the States as well. Going to slide 19 now. This is probably one of the most conventional ways to place caps at a number of places. This is a good example of the use of a conventional clamshell for placing cap material. We normally think of a clamshell as a way to dredge sediment from the bottom, you know, for purposes of dredging and disposal of the sediment. But the clamshell can be used, of course, in a reverse fashion to place a cap material. And this is a project out in Seattle called Pacific Sound Resources. And you can see that it was a conventional clamshell equipment. I think it may have been a cable arm bucket. I'm not sure of that. But you can see the little inset of the computer-generated image of overlapping each bucket placement. Just as they do this using precision positioning equipment to do dredging, to make sure that the dredging is done in as precise as possible a way, they can do the same thing for cap placement as well. They can use these positioning software programs and instruments to make sure that each bucket of capping material is placed and spread in a more or less overlapping fashion to achieve the coverage that they want to achieve. Going on to slide 20. This is an older picture of a demonstration that was done in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, where capping sand and also armor stone were placed by a clam bucket. This is a conventional clam bucket, and in fact over a geotextile in this case, at a demonstration project of capping on the Sheboygan, at the Sheboygan project. It shows an example of, you know, the idea that, you know, you can actually get out there if the site conditions allow it and very precisely place each individual bucket of material. You can see people, workers standing there guiding where each bucket went to make sure they overlapped the other ones and make sure they got the coverage of sand and stone in this case. Going on slide 21, most of you probably have heard of the Eagle Harbor project. This is a project out in Puget Sound where there was an area, I believe about 50 acres sort of a little inlet off of Puget Sound that was contaminated with PAHs. And several methods were used to cap this 50 acres. You can see one method on the right side, upper right there, and this is, you know, the split hull barge method of placement, but instead of laterally pushing it around, they were actually towing it in the more conventional way. But they essentially did lazy eights across the area they were capping. In other words, they had the tow pulling the barge. The barge was cracked open gradually over a period of maybe half an hour, a little bit more. And as they did that, they were towing it all the time. They kept moving it and just making, you know, lazy eight patterns over this area and gradually dribbling out the sand as they went. They were able to get a fairly consistent cap thickness this way. Once again, the cap target thickness was all sand at about, I think, about a 3 foot or so thickness in this case. And once again, I want to point out, too, that all the material used to cap here was dredged sand from a navigation project, and it had to be placed somewhere, so there was not an incentive to make it as thin as possible, but they were trying to get adequate coverage. So they did that over about half of the site. And then the two pictures on the left side, above and below, those are the pictures illustrating the jetting method that they use. In this case, they brought the material, the sandy material, out there on a flat top barge, and they had a fire hose that jetted it out, and you can see in the upper picture the result that it, you know, was essentially pushed into the water with the jet over, you know, most of the length of that barge. And so they were able to, you know, gradually build up a layer thickness that way. And they were able to get a more uniform thickness using this method than with the lazy H with the tow. Once again, the barge was maneuvered as they, you know, brought more material in to get to cover the area. And I think it was about 50 acres of total area that they covered at that site. Going to slide 22, this one and the next one both show the same general technique. This is a mechanical placement technique, and I haven't been able to find a color photograph of the Hamilton project, but this is a black and white that really shows how it works. It is in this case, Hamilton Harbor was a demonstration project done by the Canadians, where an area of a few acres, I believe, or they would call it hectares, I suppose, but they capped a demonstration area by bringing capping sand out to the site in a barge. They had a front-end loader that would then move that material into a hopper, you can see there. And the hopper was equipped with a manifold at the bottom, and the sand essentially just gradually fell by gravity through the manifold and was spread across the width of that manifold. And, of course, they were maneuvering the barge around, pacing the volume throughput of the front-end loader with the amount that they moved the barge to, you know, calculate how, you know, the thickness of the placement. And it was quite successful. If you go to the next slide, 23, these are some color photographs of the same type of setup. This time used at the Pan Street site in Vermont, at least over a part of the area. They used some other techniques as well there. But this shows you a better picture of what the manifold looks like. And once again, they had a track hoe sitting on a barge to place the sand into the hopper. Mechanical placement. Going on to now slide 24. This begins a series of hydraulic placement methods. This project here was at Mox Pond in Indiana. They were placing a sand cap over a geotechnical fabric at this site, and they were able to put multiple lifts, eight lifts of about 3 inches apiece using this device. And what this device really consists of is a mudcat dredge. That's the green piece of equipment that you see with a pump. And, of course, they're running the dredge pump in the opposite direction. Instead of, you know, pulling sediment from the bottom and discharging through the pipe, you can see on the upper right picture they have cap material being brought to the site in a conveyor on over into a mixing tank, and they're pumping from that tank out to the area that they're capping. And you can see the close-up in the lower left there, a manifold attached to the dredge pipe where the sand was pumped through with the holes in it like a manifold, and you can see the result in the lower right picture where the sand is being hydraulically released over the edge of the barge and building up the cap thickness that way. Quite successful. Going on to slide 25, this is the Soda Lake project that Danny mentioned earlier. This is the project that was, I've been to the site. It's in Wyoming. You wouldn't think about capping in Wyoming, but believe me, it's been done at least at this pilot level. There was a lake here that was actually a discharge point from an oil refinery, and the material was very, very oily and soft, essentially zero shear strength. But you can see they used two different methods to place this sand cap. The picture in the lower right is a mudcat dredge, once again, used in a reverse fashion, pumping through the auger mechanism that comes on the mudcat dredge in reverse. And this mudcat dredge is attached with a cable from bank to bank, and so it is capable of placing a stripe of sand from one side of the lake to the other, then come back, then move the cable over, then they overlap and go again. And by pacing the throughput of sand and the rate of movement of the piece of equipment, they can place a very thin lift. They were able to place lifts like 1.5 inches this way, and were able to successfully place this with fairly low thicknesses of mixing on this very, very soft sediment at this site. Also, you can see in the upper right picture another method they use, which some people would call rainbowing sand, to get the cap in the very near shore areas where the water was very, very shallow. They essentially just pumped it out in a rainbow fashion and let it fall back and build up cap thickness that way. Slide 26, you can see this is, I wouldn't potentially use this myself. I think this looks a little bit Rube Goldberg to me, but this is a conveyor, and you can see that they have positioned that conveyor so that stuff falls, looks like over about a 15-foot height into this trimmy. I would think they'd have a hard time keeping all that together, but you can see the operator there with the track hoe holding onto this trimmy. And what this does is allow the material to fall through the trimmy and be discharged onto the bottom without it falling through the water column. Now, I think they could have done away with the trimmy and probably done just as well with the conveyor without the trimmy, but they did it this way in this case. This picture here on slide 27 shows another hydraulic method. This is the sand spreader device, and I've been on this piece of equipment. It was used at a couple of projects in the Netherlands. It's a fairly large piece of equipment, but you can see that it involves a hydraulic pipeline coming into a spreader. And the spreader really is like a series of flumes almost that spreads that sand over the width of that barge, which is about 20, 25 feet, something like that. And it's been used quite successfully. They were placing a fairly thick sand layer over a very large lake area in the Netherlands using this spreader. Almost the same concept as what was used at Mox Pond, but a little bit larger version. Showing a couple of other pictures here. This is an extreme situation where a cap had to be placed under a structure, a pier essentially. And you can see that parts of the project was shotcreted on the left there, but parts also were placed with sediment across using a conveyor belt. So there are ways to get caps in some pretty tight spaces. There's a couple other pictures I could have pulled in that showed using these little bobcat pieces of equipment at low tide that would go up under the pier at low tide and place cap material and spread it out. But, of course, it's much more difficult to try to place a cap in a situation like this where you've got a structure in the way, but it has been done. Another unusual cap was the one placed at the Theophos Waterway out in Seattle. This was actually in Tacoma, rather. But this cap was an impermeable membrane, and you can see the thickness of the membrane and how stiff it is in that lower picture there. It looked like to be about 3/4 of an inch thick or so. Very robust piece of equipment, but this cap had to be placed over a fairly small area where we had napple and high groundwater flow velocities, which is a very difficult combination of conditions to deal with a cap. But it was an old coal gas plant site with a fairly small area that had this condition, but to dredge it out would have been not only expensive, but would have undermined some very expensive infrastructure around the place. And so a cap was proposed and designed for this using this impermeable membrane. So that's an example of some unusual ways that a cap can be considered. Anacostia, Danny mentioned Anacostia already. I've got a few other pictures that he had furnished to us from Anacostia. This is a picture here of the aqua block being placed at Anacostia with a conventional clamshell. And here's a nice little table that shows a couple of examples of the target thicknesses versus the observed thicknesses for placement. For instance, with a sand-only cap, the target was 12. They had an average of 9 plus or minus 3.2. That tells you a little bit about the variability of the thickness using a conventional clam. Aqua block, you can see the same type of information using the different materials and different target thicknesses for that. Now, of course, with the Coke, they were using a mat placement technique there. But you can see, too, with AquaBlock, in attempting to place a 4-inch thickness, they average 5.8 plus or minus 2. So that's some data. This is the type of data we really need to collect more of at more different, more sites of differing site conditions, so we can get a better handle on how effective different placement approaches can be in getting that, thin layers and also uniform layers. A couple other pictures. I think he showed you this as part of his presentation on Anacostia for the reactive mat.
This is slide 32, Mike?
Yeah, that was slide 32. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I have to say my number. I'll let you catch up with me. That was slide 32 with Anacostia, the same one that Danny showed. Now I'm going to 33. These slides are a series of slides from the McCormick and Baxter plant, and they were doing armoring and some other cap materials to include, I think, a reactive mat here at the McCormick and Baxter site. You can see this method they used on slide 33, the method they used to place an armor layer. They also used conveyor placement with a trimming similar to the one we showed earlier here in slide 34. And then in slide 35, you can see the finished product as far as the placement of the armor right up, up above the water surface up the shoreline. And on slide 36, this is a picture here of how each individual strip of this armor material was actually placed with a crane and a sling. So there's a number of ways to place sand. In fact, going to slide 37. This is a slide that illustrates what I mentioned in the very first part of my talk when I talked about resuspension silk curtains. This is my favorite silk curtain slide. And, of course, I mentioned that cap materials have been placed behind silk curtains, and this is where it was done. This is another picture of the Simpson Craft Tacoma site where they use that sandbox to place the cap material at the end of the discharge pipe with a hydraulic placement. You can also see some shore work going on here, but right out there in the middle you can see that discharge pipe where that sandbox is operating. Of course, you may be a little confused. That water looks clear, and all the natural water outside the silk curtain is very turbid. So that's, sort of my favorite silk curtain slide. We were very much protecting our capping area from the turbid natural turbidity coming out the Snohomish River in that case. But anyway, the silk curtain looked to be pretty effective at doing that. And going to slide 38, this is a picture that I got out of the World Dredging and Marine Construction Journal Periodical Magazine. That shows a stone placement operation. I think this was somewhere in Europe, if I remember right. But it shows you that there are a lot of equipment configurations and scales that you could consider. For instance, if you had to place stone armor layer over, a large, large area, something like this might be, lined up, being implemented by a contractor where barges of the stone material are moved in, placed in hoppers. In this case, this is a barge that has perforations where all those squares are, and the stone could be placed in each square, and that way they get the coverage and overlap that they want to get. Going to slide 39, departing from the pictures now and into a little pitch here. Just as we would have an operations plan for an environmental dredging project that would spell out where the dredging would take place, what the different prisms would be for acceptance areas and things like that, we would have the same considerations that should be laid out for our capping project in a capping operations plan. In other words, that plan should include or should be a written plan that lays out the details of where the capping is going to take place, what the prisms look like, what type of equipment might be used. And, of course, this plan could be finalized once a contract is let, so the contractor would be inputting into the plan, perhaps. But then it would also talk about things like how the sequence of the work would be done. In other words, are you going to cap from, say, an upstream area to a downstream area, or from the area of shallow water back down toward a deeper water, that kind of thing. It would also lay out where the cap material is coming from, how it would be transported to the site, how the access areas and staging areas would be arranged, In other words, how that rehandling of materials would take place. And then also it would, you know, provide a schedule. And you may be doing this work, for instance, within a dredge, what we usually would call them dredging windows, but in this case it would be a capping window. And it would also lay out, you know, how the construction monitoring would take place. And going to slide 40, this is the slide on monitoring. I'm touching on monitoring because it's really part of implementation, it's part of design, too, that, that you would be considering the need to monitor in your cap design, you know, how you're going to be able to go out, say, and take cores or do bathymetry or whatever it might be. In looking at a monitoring program for capping, there's a few things that are very important. First of all, there's two different phases to worry about usually with the capping project. There is the construction monitoring phase, and then there's a long-term monitoring phase. For these cap, and then there also might be a severe event trigger also, and I'll touch on that. Usually, the approaches we use for cap monitoring include taking bathymetry, which would, you know, give you an overall look at the site, and then there would be supplemented, that would be supplemented by a coring program, taking cores down through the cap into the sediment over time. During the construction phase for construction monitoring, that's when you'd be concerned about perhaps monitoring for resuspension that might take place due to the cap placement. But you would be concerned very, very much so with the cap construction and to ensure that the thickness of the different cap layers are, that that thickness is placed properly and the coverage is there and the variation is within acceptable limits. And, of course, we already talked about the mixing of the two layers of the, of the, of the cap with the underlying sediment. Your monitoring program might even determine what mixing thicknesses were actually, you know, occurring in the field. It's all to do with how that cap is constructed and how the cap thickness is, you know, winds up in the field as the construction process goes forward. Once the construction phase is done and everybody declares victory and goes home and says this cap is completed, that's not the end of monitoring. All these capping projects for purposes of remediation are going to have some sort of a long-term monitoring program established for them. We're usually interested in chemical isolation and physical stability, those two things. And so at some interval, some frequency, we will be looking at is that cap remaining there, is it physically stable, and is it still doing its job as far as its ability to contain the contamination and isolate the contaminated sediments from the environment. And that usually, once again, involves coring. Usually we look at cores as the principal technique. We can take a core down through there and see that the isolation component of the cap is doing its job and that the zone of compliance, which is usually in the biologically active zone, is still meeting its target in the long term. And then the third type of monitoring that occurs might be a trigger due to some event. Because we have to design the cap to be physically stable, we might be designing that cap to withstand, say, a 100-year event from a flood or from some sort of a storm that produces waves. But there would be a monitoring trigger that would take place when some event occurs. For instance, we might, as an example, say that the cap was designed for a 100-year event, but if a 50-year event occurs, that may trigger a monitoring excursion where we go out and do, say, bathymetry or do a set of cores, or some other event may trigger. For instance, an ice event might trigger a monitoring event for physical stability. And that should be written into the monitoring plan. And also the last bullet, this is a written plan. And also the plan should include management actions because the golden rule of monitoring is you don't do it unless you know what you're going to do with the information. And so the monitoring plan should clearly lay out, you know, what information is going to be collected and what you will do in the event you see one thing or the other occur. Those management actions might include increasing the scope of the monitoring if you see something that you don't like. It might include adding material to increase the thickness of the cap where it has say, been compromised by some ice scour or erosion in some places. It might be, using a different material. It might even include something more responsive, like bringing in an additional cap layer if you see a problem that you did not anticipate. So those are the types of things that should be included in as part of the monitoring plan. They would be focused on management actions that would occur based on what you see with the monitoring. That is the end of my slides. I'm on 41. That shows my nice spreading barge again. And I guess I'm going to turn this over to Kelly for a little question and answer period. I hope I'm on time.
Yes, definitely on time, Mike. Thanks for the presentation. As Mike alluded to, we're going to have we have time, and we're going to have some Q&A. And so those on the phone, while you unmute, I'll ask a few questions that were submitted online. One was, could you comment on sediment gas generation as a consideration in remedial design as well as release?
Yeah, well, Danny, I think, touched on that just for a second, too. Everyone seems to bring up what they call it, ebullition, I think, gas generation, and does it really create a problem or should it be part of our design? This is actually mostly an issue where we have NAPL. It has been studied at a number of sites. I've yet to see, even with sites with NAPL and considerable gas generation, I've yet to see any information that would indicate as any problem with respect to migration of contaminants. You've seen the bubbles that are brought up. Sometimes, like at the PFAS site, for instance, that site actually, the bubbles would come up and it would cause a little sheen at the surface. That's probably one site where the gas bubble generation was the actual impetus to put that very robust cap down. But for most situations I've seen on cap design, the gas generation has not turned out to be a big issue at all with respect to contaminant migration. Keep in mind, too, that the gas is generated more so when the warm weather occurs, and when you put a cap down, you further isolate the surface of that contaminated sediment layer from, the processes that cause the gas to be generated in the first place. So we've yet to see it to be a real problem.
Great. And another question submitted online before we go to the phones. Can you comment on the lift thickness achieved using the approach at Lake Kettleman or?
Oh, Kettlemere.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember. I think the total thick. Actually, what they did with one of those projects, they placed a layer of clean clay content sediment at the bottom of the lake to form a pseudo liner across this site. Then they also used it to place sand as well. I'm thinking that the layer thickness that they were looking at were probably in excess of a couple of feet. They were not real, real thin lifts for that particular piece of equipment.
Good. I guess we'd open it up to the phones now for those who might have questions. Any questions, comments?
This is Steve Johnson here in Region 5 again. I've got a lagoon with about 30 feet of semi-liquid sludge. Doesn't have any shear strength at all. And we've been discussing caps, and we've got a lab test that's going on to do various different practical fish tank tests to see what kind of cap we can make. I suggested to the contractor to consider shingling placement. That most everybody always thinks about rolls and mats and granular covers. But it seemed like to me that there's probably just as good a reason to discuss just laying out shingles of various geotextile materials and allowing them to fall as they may, just like you would a roof.
Okay. You mean like not attached to one another, but just like squares, 10 feet square or something like that?
Yeah, that's right. And eventually you'll get a good cap.
Well, that seems like an interesting idea. Once again, the questions I would have is how do you get those to the bottom, and I would, rather than just randomly place them, I would think one approach might be to, purposely place them, and intentionally try to overlap them. But I would, I'd ask too, why not unroll longer strips? Is there some sort of a problem with doing that at the site that you can't unroll the strip from the water surface?
Don't know. I haven't really gotten that far yet. What I do know is that we're not likely to be able to, you know, achieve full decontamination of the water above it. It's a lagoon. It's not a river.
Uh-huh.
It's not a pond. It's a true sludge lagoon.
Uh-huh.
And but we treat it as a pond because it's pretty big. It's like 16, 17 acres. So point is that we may wind up with a buoyant cap on top if, you know, figuring that the consolidation cap that we're thinking of laying down to try to consolidate the material is going to only serve one of the two purposes, which is to achieve, to improve ground, improve the soil, and then we'll put on some kind of a floating cap on top of the lagoon just to prevent it from reverting to an ecosystem.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you got very thick layers of very, very low shear strength material, it's difficult, and you've got to do something to distribute the load. And, of course, geotextiles have been used at a few sites. The first one that I'm aware of was ever done was over in Norway. They had a geotextile with a sand cap placed on top of that. We've since had some geotextiles used at a couple of projects in the States, and you know, there's different ways of laying this stuff out. The method that you're describing might be workable, but I would be worried that unless you had some way to control how it was spread out, that, you know, they may just sink to the bottom as a ball of cloth rather than spread out. So,
well,
I'd watch all that closely.
We've been experimenting with organic mulch and wood chips and just sand and, you know, all sorts of different material. We've got about five or six different alternatives. So we laid out a bunch of fish tanks and monitored them over about a month.
Well, the Japanese once, you probably recognize the Minamata Bay as an important contaminated site.
Yeah,
you know, with the mercury contamination.
Sure.
They did some dredging over there and placed some material in a confined dike area, very soft materials, very high contamination. And they had to place a surface cover over that site, and, of course, it was very, very soft. And the way they did that one, they placed a layer of straw down. They actually got out there with small boats and cable and went across the site in small boats, laid out a layer of straw first. Then they tried to put sand on top of that, and that turned out to work. The sand distributed the load just enough the straw distributed the load just enough that the sand was able to take hold, and they were able to build up layers of sand. So
that story from Giroux is exactly the story I told the guys and the contractors. You know, that's how geotextile first started, and I argued it, and we wound up with mulch, which is pretty cheap.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I think any number of things might be workable, but sure, you know, I think one thing I would do is as you go forward with anything like that, be prepared to be flexible and to change direction if you see it's not working. A little power might be helpful, too.
Minamata, where is the story written up for Minamata?
If you look at the Corps of Engineers website at Waterways Experiment Station and you look under the Dewar Research Program and you look for a tech note that says something about control measures for CDFs, you'll see a little write-up about it there, I think one or two pictures.
Thanks.
Great. We have another question online for you, Mike. Typically, what do you consider long-term with respect to monitoring the cap for the physical stability and chemical isolation?
Okay. Well, that's a good question. You know, none of these projects has extended out, you know, decades yet. Usually, the monitoring programs would have a frequency that would be decreasing in frequency as time goes on. An example I would use is that if I had a isolation cap, I would look at construction monitoring first, and then you might monitor that project, say, a year out to make sure everything's fine. You might, if you see no problems, you might extend the period to 2 years, maybe then to 5 years. If you see no problem after that, you might not even monitor again for 10 years. Of course, you still have your trigger for an extreme event in there if something like that occurs. But once you get out, you know, 10 years, then you come into, you know, how do I view this in the long term, and how often should I spend money to monitor it if I've seen no problem for 10 years, and do I do this for 30 years? Like we do landfills is what my understanding is. We have 30-year programs for landfills. Well, what do you do after 30 years? Well, these are very good questions. And then it comes to the issue of how is that paid for? And in many cases, I think we have to think in terms of some sort of a escrow fund that would be set up to have the money there to continue doing the monitoring. You know, some administrative mechanism to get that done. But I don't have an answer to, you know, what's the cutoff. I do know that we need to be consistent in our thinking between the various alternatives. If we're going to, say, dredge the material and put it in a landfill, well, what is the length of time we're going to require monitoring on that landfill? And how does that compare to what we might consider for, you know, a TAM frequency for monitoring a cap?
Okay. Is there any other questions over the phone? People have over the phone now?
This is Margaret Burnett from Wisconsin DNR. And I think my question goes to that administrative issue you were just talking about. If you've got a private party who's responsible for doing this cleanup, how do you hold them on the hook, you know, for 30-plus years? You know, and I understand your comment about possibly an escrow account and things like that, but have you had any experience with what other administrative options you might use to keep them in this monitoring program?
Well, when you say experience, I have not seen yet any specific examples of that. It is mentioned, you know, as a consideration, but I've not seen an example of an agreement, you know, a legal agreement between a regulating agency and a private party that would spell it out that way. But to me, that has got to be the approach that you would consider. They've got to come to an agreement. I mean, we can't rely on, you know, a company to be in business and to continue to do what they've got to do over decades. Experience has not been very good on that front. So, you know, I think it's good to think in terms of getting an agreement in place that would form a mechanism where money would be there to continue looking at the site in the long term. That's what you got to do.
I mean, that's great. If there's no more burning questions out there, I think we're going to try to wrap this up since we only have about 5 minutes left. Again, we do have emails, and they are hot linked on this website that you can go to the instructors as well. So in wrapping up, again, I'd wish to thank Danny and Mike for providing the presentations and for their effort. I would also like to thank the participants for being on this webcast. And again, we plan on archiving this session with the audio, the soundtrack as well. And then we will also, there are links to many of the resources that were mentioned here today on this website, including web pages. And again, I would ask that you fill out the form that's online. We do look at these and try to improve the course as we move along. And then finally, hopefully, many of you will be joining us next Monday, October the 23rd, at the same time as we go into the second part of the series, which will be focused on environmental dredging, and Mike will be one half of that speaker next week. So with that said, I wish to thank everyone, and goodbye. Thanks again.